Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa. God knows you put your life into it.
This is Third Paradigm, a twice weekly think tank about how to take back control of our cities, farmland, and water, of money, production, and trade, of media, education, and culture, of religion, and even of an out-of-control biblical God. Thursdays, we focus on economics and community sovereignty, and the Sunday edition puts religion in bed with politics. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting from Free Radio Santa Cruz. Welcome to Third Paradigm. That was Take Back the City from the indie band Snow Patrol. Lead vocalist Gary Lightbody reports that this song broke from his usual theme of romantic disaster. A native of Northern Ireland, he conceived of this as a love song for Belfast, but ended up writing it in Berlin. Both cities contributed to the grit and rawness of the lyrics. What makes it particularly apt as the theme for Third Paradigm is the sense of personal responsibility in the line, "Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me." If we are going to redeem our cities and the countryside in between where the food is grown, it won't happen by holding someone else responsible, even if they are. Today is Thursday and the day of giving thanks for our food. But the global food system has never been so broken. We'll look at the heartbreaking statistics and the even more disheartening projections. But we'll also look at the success in food sovereignty movements that the twin tsunamis of the economic and food crises have inadvertently cleared the way for. Meanwhile, here in the States, the banks, auto industry, and stimulus packages are circling like sharks to get their bite of the wounded U.S. Treasury before it sinks for good. From the grassroots, however, the new president-elect has become everyone's favorite pen pal, with a wall of letters from within the U.S. and a flurry of earnest posts from around the world. And so I've added my own two bits as a housewife, called Obama, Listen to Your Mother. Everything I know about governing, I learn from raising kids. We'll guess how Obama's mother might deal with institutions that have gotten too big for their britches. Is it politically incorrect to spank a bank? But before these urgent questions, a Thanksgiving grace by Rafael Jesus Gonzalez. Thanks and blessing be to the sun and the earth for this bread and this wine, this fruit, this meat, this salt, this food. Thanks be and blessing to them who prepare it, who serve it. Thanks and blessings to them who share it, and also the absent and the dead. Thanks and blessings to them who bring it, may they not want. To them who plant and tend it, harvest and gather it, may they not want. Thanks and blessings to them who work, and blessings to them who cannot. May they not want, for their hunger sours the wine and robs the taste from the salt. Thanks be for the sustenance and strength, for our dance and work of justice, of peace. That's by Rafael Jesus Gonzalez from In Praise of Fertile Land, edited by Claudia Morrow. My own Thanksgiving celebration has taken a different turn from the sociable gathering of extended family around a heavily laden table. Several years ago, I realized that I had the nature of a closet monk with a visceral craving for solitude. Maybe this should have occurred to me before I had three kids, all of whom were pretty young at the time. In response, my husband gave me the nicest of gifts, time alone. Each Thanksgiving, he takes the family to Los Angeles to visit his sister without me. Although I wish I could clone myself and be in both places at once, My writing sabbaticals at home have become precious to me. Each Thanksgiving I spend in my clean and empty house, I'm filled with gratitude. I'm thankful to him and to my daughters for letting me go, or stay, as the case may be. To my sister-in-law, Joan, who, as a fellow mom, never makes me feel guilty. And to her extensive Colombian in-laws for giving my family the boisterous, social, more is merrier holiday that they crave. This break from the norm, however, has made me more connected to global food conditions around this time of year, and more reflective about the subtext of divinely sanctioned entitlement that underlies our rituals and traditions. In this sense, it's probably better for everyone that I'm sequestered and quarantined. These insights of mine can spoil the mood faster than a flatulent uncle. But because it's still early in the day, before we've put on our faux pilgrim roles, I'll read the poem I wrote on Thanksgiving Eve in the year 2005. I will not thank God. I will not thank God for my food on a day when children starve. What kind of God would I thank? A God who gives to some and keeps from others? A God who grants wishes and denies need? A God who lavishes some at others' expense? To thank God is to choose not to see the farm worker, the agribusiness factory, the machine that sets the pace, rather than easing the work. It's as if it all appeared by magic, untouched by human hands. To the woman in the hairnet, her fingers arthritic in the cold processing plant, I give my thanks. To the young boy mechanically slaughtering turkeys, numb to his heartless task, I give my thanks. To the frugal men in the field, risking all to send money home to their wives and hungry children, I give my thanks. There, but for the grace of God, go I. What the heck does that mean? If God's grace strips the fruit of another's labor for my bounty, God is a creep. I'll thank God when he shows some human decency, or when we humans show some moral honesty. This is Teresa Caraggio with Third Paradigm. We'll return after this break.
Raise your hopeful voice. You have
That was Glenn Hansard and Marketa Erglova doing Falling Slowly from the soundtrack of Once, which is a wonderful indie film if you haven't seen it, refreshing for the non-sappy story it tells of a friendship that doesn't become a romance, intertwined with some of the most wistful, stirring music and evocative lyrics I've heard. I also think that the sentiment that we still have time to take this sinking boat and turn it around is a hopeful message for our era. Well, it's Thanksgiving Day 2008, and we're in a global food crisis on a scale which is unprecedented in history and hopefully will be the turning point in the apex of hunger. But it looks to get worse before it gets better. From this month's Food First backgrounder, I read, the UN World Food Program predicts a jump in the number of hungry people in the world from 860 million to more than 1 billion people, one of every six people in the world. Retail food prices in the U.S. increased 4% last year, driven by a combination of speculation, high oil prices, agro-fuel consumption, a weak dollar, climactic events, and historically low grain reserves. The USDA projects that price increases will total another 3-4% in 2008. The steepest increase in 17 years. I think that probably should be 2009. The 35 million food insecure people in the U.S. who are most affected by the food price crisis may be joined by 50 million others living at or near the poverty level. To put this in context, however, the price of rice, which is the staple food of 3 billion people, or half the world's population, rose 50% in just 2 weeks in April. The food crisis is coming home to roost, but only after the dragon has ravaged and scorched the rest of the world. Yesterday, alternative radio broadcast David Barsamian's interview of Raj Patel, former director of Food First and author of Stuffed and Starved. He stated that everything he knows about food, he's learned from Via Campesina, the international coalition of 150 million peasant farmers, rural women, and indigenous communities around the world. Well, everything that I know about Via Campesina, I've learned from Food First and Grassroots International, another great organization that's just published a downloadable curriculum on food sovereignty. In short, food sovereignty is the right to feed yourself and your family through access to the land and the country's obligation to prioritize food over profits in the use of the land's resources. In October, Via Campesina held their fifth annual conference in Maputo, Mozambique. The declaration that resulted begins, "We are men and women of the earth. We are those who produce food for the earth. We have the right to continue being peasants and family farmers, and to shoulder the responsibility of continuing to feed our people. We care for seeds, which are life. And for us, the act of producing food is an act of love. Humanity depends on us, and we refuse to disappear." The women also gathered in their third conference and produced a declaration of their own, whose tone is decidedly both warm and tough. "We find ourselves surrounded by the happiness of sharing, the affection of our compañeras, the richness of our diverse cultures, and the beauty of the women of Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Americas. We are women with a history and common struggles for life, land, and territory, food sovereignty, justice, and dignity. We are women who share knowledge and experiences, convinced that ideas, like seeds, grow and reproduce when they are exchanged. We are women who have struggled against violence across history, fighters who continue to defend our territories and cultures from pillage, devastation, and death perpetrated by those who have imposed their power since the time of colonialism, and today continue trying to colonize not only our territories, but also our minds and our lives." Finally, the youth held their second ever conference and wrote a declaration that begins like poetry, which is the part I'll read, but also ends with a detailed action plan. "The countryside is our life. The earth feeds us. The rivers run in our blood. We are the youth of the Via Campesina. Today we declare the beginning of a new world. We come from the four corners of the world to stand together in the spirit of resistance, to work together to create hope, to talk together about our struggles, to learn from each other's work, to be inspired by each other's songs, music, and stories, to build solidarity between our movements, to unite as a strong force for social change. From here we go forward to the four corners of the world. We carry with us a spirit of revolution, the conviction that another world is possible, and the dedication to fight for our way of life. We will fight until we win, until youth all over the world are able to live in the countryside as campesinos with peace and prosperity. When the state tries to repress us, we will unite in solidarity and continue the struggle. When a companera falls, we will pick her up. When it gets cold, we will embrace each other so that the fire of our struggle will warm our hearts. And each day we will place our bodies, our minds, and our hearts on the line and fight for life and fight for La Via Campesina. As a mother of teenage daughters, I can't help but notice that they've worked romance into the revolution. And so we'll play David Rovick's Behind the Barricades, and when we return, we'll have my letter to Obama.
When the world has gone crazy, and it's all becoming clear, when they're gunning down our comrades, and it seems the end is near, as they're loading up the launchers for the tear gas grenades, we can take off our bandanas and kiss behind the barricades. When it's madness all around, and you can see this at a glance, we will sing and we will cry, we will laugh and we will dance. As they shout their marching orders beneath the helicopter blades, we shall seize the moment for a kiss behind the barricades. They will try to break our spirit, and at times they may succeed, but our love for the world is stronger than their greed. When the building is surrounded and hope begins to fade, in my final hour, a kiss behind the barricades. As the movement grows, there will be hills and bends, but at the center of the struggle are your lovers and your friends. And the more we hold each other up, the less we can be swayed. Here's to love and solidarity, and a kiss behind the barricades.
That was David Rovick's with Behind the Barricades. For the final segment of our Thanksgiving show, everyone seems to be writing letters to Obama. Julie Mertes, author of Bait and Switch, Human Rights and U.S. Foreign Policy, outlines four steps for him to repair our tattered reputation. Rosa Anaya, daughter of assassinated Salvadoran human rights lawyer Herbert Anaya Sanabria, reminds Obama that there are 35 sovereign countries in the Americas and almost 200 in the world. To be a good U.S. president, he must not try to be president of the world. The Indigenous Councils of Colombia write, by transforming life into merchandise, by making sacred the accumulation of wealth, by enshrining greed, we believe our societies have entered a crisis, including the economic crisis currently faced by your country. They ask that together we create the conditions for a new history. Alice Walker cautions him to relax and enjoy his family, and remember that he didn't create this mess, while Garrison Keillor says to not play golf or get a dog. So now I'll add my 2 cents. Dear President-to-be Obama, the only authority I have to tell you what to do is from being a mother. But as you know from having had one and being married to one, it teaches you a thing or two. I'd like to impart 6 of the lessons I've learned that I think might be of help to you. Lesson 1. Sometimes everyone needs a time out. Thanks to you, for a brief moment in time, the U.S. has a clean slate. The rest of the world is watching and waiting, but we have a temporary reprieve from guilt. I'd like you to give the U.S. a 1-year time out to reflect on our actions, work through our differences, and come up with a plan to be better. Let 2009 be a year of staying in our corner. No new wars, no new debts, and no new trade agreements. Give us a year to catch our breath and stop fighting fires or setting new ones. Our task during this time will be to come up with a 2020 vision. How we, as cities, counties, and states, propose to get our communities out of our portion of, say, the national debt, or global warming, or the consumer society, or unemployment. Little things like that. Lesson 2. Smaller is better in taking responsibility. I know that goes against the grain in empire building, but if you want to foster responsibility and cooperation, it's better to try a whole bunch of little solutions to bite-sized portions of the problem than go for a grand scheme. Never eat anything bigger than your own head, my mother used to say. Lesson 3. Guilt makes kids behave badly. I know you've seen this too. When one of your girls gets hurt and the other clearly had nothing to do with it, the natural reaction is compassion. When the other one might have had something to do with it, the first thing you hear is, "It's not my fault. She started it." Insult gets added to injury in the rush to defend themselves, and the cycle continues. That's why we need to extend this temporary reprieve. Lesson 4. Feeling better and making it better doesn't necessarily happen in that order. Understanding the relationship between how we're treating others and how they're treating us is going to make us feel bad. That's necessary. This may not seem fair when we're already down and out with the economy, but we need it. Who stops doing bad things while it still feels good? You can't make kids feel better about themselves in order to make them then do better. You can only give them a chance to make things better, and feeling better about themselves will come. Lesson 5. You can't control your kids. You go into parenting thinking that you can, but sooner or later you figure out that they're the only ones who can control themselves. If you're lucky, you figure out this sooner, because sooner is better when it comes to failing. Maybe we've missed this boat, but I agree that it's not too late. And finally, lesson 5, you can and must control the money. Economy comes from the Greek word economia, which means the management of the household. The money that goes anywhere comes from you, and the behavior you reward is the behavior that you'll see. So, I suggest that if any military office or foreign government tortures or terrorizes, we suspend their allowance, also known as military aid. We stop taxing earned income at a higher rate than speculation, which can also be called gambling. Let's let raising kids be a write-off, not corporate offices and perks. This has been Third Paradigm. If you, President Obama, or anyone else would like to respond, my email address is Tereza, T-E-R-E-Z-A, at retrometro.com. Thank you for listening, and thank you to Skidmark Bob for production and editing help. Here, or am I dreaming? I can't tell dreams from truth.